Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So we've talked a lot about Cliff Kingsbury's start fast, fade late narrative. And been talking about it for a while. But Bill Barnwell, who digs deep and does really good work, wrote about it yesterday, and he joins us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. Bet smarter, beat the books. Download the BetQL app today or visit BetQL.com. So I wanted to actually start with, you know, you wrote a lot about the game on Sunday. ESPN's Bill Barnwell did, who joins us right now. And you wrote something that I wanted to make sure that I understood clearly. You wrote that since 2000, 94 teams have started drives inside their 20-yard line with 40 seconds or less left to go, out of timeouts and needing a touchdown to potentially tie or win the game. The Commanders are the first of those teams to score a touchdown in that situation. That shocked me. I would have thought that it would have happened more than zero times before Sunday, but what I wanted clarification on was, were you referring to winning it without a Hail Mary or just, you know, scoring a touchdown anyway?
Period. Scoring a touchdown or scoring with a Hail Mary. I know last year it was a little longer of a period of time. I know that the Commanders-Broncos game, the Broncos hit that Hail Mary from midfield, and that was similar-ish, but it was not a there was a little bit more time on the clock. But yes, this was the only one Hail Mary, non-Hail Mary scoring in that situation.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I actually forgot about that. Russell Wilson threw that pass, and then they missed on a two-point conversion in which I think Washington got away with a major defensive pass interference on the two-point conversion. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you'll take it, right? Obviously, you know, a similar situation where you get the crazy play to tie up the game, and then obviously different. They needed a two-pointer. I think it was they were down by two, if I'm not mistaken, last year. This was a situation where the Commanders obviously could have kicked the extra point, could have gone for two to try and win. But, you know, same situation.
Well, no, Denver was down eight. They were down eight. And what you're saying is that it was close to the scenario of Sunday, but it wasn't. They were down two, so they had to go for the two-point conversion to try to tie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. So the Commanders obviously had a choice, but the same situation where you get the big play and then you don't get
you're talking about
much
Sunday,
easier
my fault.
Thing that
yeah.
happens after the big play.
Yeah, got it. I was shocked to hear that. I just would have thought that it would have happened, you know, multiple times, let alone, you know, not zero.
Yeah, I was surprised too, but I went through and I double-checked it, triple-checked it, and it's hard. I mean, think about it. 40 seconds, no timeouts. You have to go the length of the field. I mean, 80-plus yards and, you know, when you think about, okay, how would it happen? You think, okay, maybe you get one big play and then you get a couple of, you know, smaller chunks here and there. You don't think you're going to get it in one fell swoop. But not only did they get it in one fell swoop, but it was almost easy. It almost felt like it was, you know, like Terry McLaurin barely was, he didn't even get touched.
He didn't get touched.
That was so remarkable to me.
Yeah, he didn't get touched, Bill, and I went back and watched it a little bit more yesterday. There's no doubt that at least one defender for the Cowboys is essentially playing to protect the sideline to not let him go out of bounds, and Terry had no interest in going out of bounds. He just decided to outrun everybody. By the way, before we get to the Cliff Kingsbury stuff, it sounds like you kind of felt the same way I did, which is, there was no easy answer on whether or not to go for two in that spot, that, you know, kicking was probably, you know, I don't even know what the analytics said personally. The context of it for me was kind of 50-50. I leaned a little bit going for it in the moment, but I totally understood why he didn't. Sounds like you felt the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can make a strong, you know, an airtight case that you needed to go for it or you needed to kick the extra point, because there's so many soft factors that are hard to analyze here, right? I mean, you have the on one side going for two, you have the shell shock effect, right? I mean, the Cowboys just gave up an 80-plus yard touchdown. The stadium is going crazy. Their defenders are just straight up tired from chasing Terry McLaurin. I mean, I can understand the chaos of that situation and wanting to take advantage of that, you know, from that side. But then you flip it. We don't know how good Austin Siebert really is after the hip injury. He missed the two kicks earlier in the game. You know, I think when you think about trying to build like a model to analyze this stuff, you say, okay, these are what the averages is. This is what we would expect from history. But this was such a unique case with so many different factors that are hard to account for that I don't think you can really blame them for one or the other. I lean more towards going for two, as you do, just because it's just, you know, really the strength of the football team is Jaden Daniels' short yardage. Right. I know they had a two-point play earlier, so you burned already, you know, what your best two-point play, but there's enough in the playbook that I feel confident I would have leaned towards that being the strength of the team. And, I mean, at the end of the day, like, here's the question that I think we always talk about when it comes to this stuff. If you're the Dallas Cowboys, what do you want the Commanders to do? Are you scared if they kick an extra point and they're going to play for overtime, or are you more scared if they're going to go for two? If you're more scared if they're going to go for two, then you should probably go for two.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the shell shock thing, which I talked about, you could actually make the case that that's also one of the reasons to kick, is that they're, you know, basically they're feeling what's happened to them all year is happening again, which is they're going to lose. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you know, so, I mean, and you have Cooper Rush on the sideline too, so, you know, I don't want to trash Dan Quinn for that decision. I think there's somewhere it's more obvious. I don't think this is one of them.
I actually think the one that was much more cut and dried, but we kind of got the answer as to why they didn't do it, and that is that Seibert probably couldn't do it. But kicking to Turpin was a terrible idea. You know, that was a kick it, you know, out of the end zone situation, but it sounds like Seibert perhaps wasn't capable of doing it on Sunday, which would have, you know, certainly brought up the conversation, well, maybe you should have had a kicker that could, given how great Turpin is as a returner.
Yeah, and coaches are pretty lax about kickers. I think when you have a guy you like, and Seibert was so good earlier in the season, it's almost like you want to rush back to him. You know, I, of course, spent a lot of time covering the Giants, and same thing happened with Graham Gano, where they had Graham Gano was injured during the week. They didn't want to call up a kicker. They wanted to kind of trust him to go through it. He gets hurt early in that game, and then they're, you know, losing the game because of it. So, you know, it's such a tough position to gauge. But teams put so little effort into sort of understanding so much, you know, there's so much interest in like the name brand. Like, once you have a guy you like, you want to do whatever you can to get him out there. You're going to trust him. And clearly they developed trust in Siebert, and I don't blame him. He clearly isn't 100%, but, you know, it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't have been better off without a healthier kicker, even if he wasn't of Siebert's caliber, for that game on Sunday.
Talking to Bill Barnwell at Bill Barnwell on X, ESPN's Bill Barnwell. All right, let's get to the reason that I reached out to you yesterday, because like I mentioned to you, we've been talking a lot about the Cliff Kingsbury thing, you know, starts fast, fades late, and the teams that he's been the head coach of. But we've been talking, Denton and I have, going back to even before the season started, that there's a lot of variables involved and a lot of variance in season to season as to why the team's records faded late. You went and you did the homework, per usual, Bill, because this is, you do this so well. So tell everybody what you learned about the, you know, the narrative of Cliff Kingsbury's offenses, okay, start fast, fade late.
Yeah, okay, so let's split this up a little bit. Let's start with the college side of things, because I've seen a lot of evidence, people saying, hey, it's not just a Cardinals thing, it's also go back to Texas Tech, and he's had problems there. Well, yes, the offense has declined from the first half of the season to the second half of the season. The records declined. But if you pay attention to college football, you can probably think about why that might be the case. It's scheduling. First half of the year, Texas Tech was playing, you know, all these small schools in Texas, the Sam Houstons, the UTEPs, you know, schools they were dropping 60 on, and they weren't playing their Big 12 schedule. And when you got to the second half of the year, they were playing all Big 12 teams, so understandably their record got worse, and they were scoring fewer points. When you take that out, when you take out the, you know, the independent teams, the D2 teams, all that stuff, there is an effect. They were worse in the second half, but it was mostly the defense. The offense declined by about 2 points per game. Defense declined by 10 points per game, which makes sense. You're playing tougher competition, and that was never a school that was investing a lot on the defensive side of the football. They were playing at a crazy pace, probably more defensive injuries, all reasons to think, okay, there might be factors here, but it's not like teams are figuring out Cliff Kingsbury's scheme in the second half of his seasons at Texas Tech. And then you go to Arizona, go to the Cardinals. Okay, first year, record did decline in the second half, but the offense got better. They scored more points per game. That's kind of a tough argument. Next couple of years, 1 year you have Kyler Murray tears ACL. So Kyler Murray misses basically the entire second half of the season. I think he played one full game second half of the year. Another year, DeAndre Hopkins, their star receiver, plays the entire first half of the season. They get that Hail Mary to beat the Bills. Kyler is an MVP favorite. DeAndre Hopkins plays two games the rest of the way, I believe, or one and a half games the rest of the way. He's not healthy. So you're down your best player maybe on offense or defense the second half of the season there. So could you say Cliff Kingsbury's maybe putting his players at risk? I don't think I'm qualified to say. But what I can say is, do I think there's something about Cliff Kingsbury's scheme, you know, the offense he's running that people are figuring out? I don't think so. And the other thing I would say, Kevin, and this is also comes into play here when it comes to the evaluation process. Okay, let's say Cliff Kingsbury was running a very simple scheme that teams were able to figure out. It was really easy. First half of the year, he's great. Okay, teams figure it out. Second half of the year, he struggles. Okay, why would they be good the first half of the following year? It's not like you forget what the tape is. It's not like, you know, it's not like you suddenly like, oh, you're, it's not a Men in Black situation. You know, wipe your memory. Like, all the stuff you learn from the first half of the tape, you would still have. So I don't think Cliff is, you know, bringing in a brand new offense the first half of each year. You're making changes, of course, during the offseason. You're adding some wrinkles here and there. But it's just tough for me to find a through line that makes sense here in terms of Cliff Kingsbury's scheme. There's other factors here, I think, that explain why there's been a second half decline.
Yeah, that's really well done. And the last point, such a good one. If he was so predictable and so easy to figure out in the second half of seasons, why didn't that carry over to the first part of the next season? Why didn't they learn from the previous seasons? And just to give even more detail to the Texas Tech argument, which you wrote about, you know, in the second halves of seasons after they had played the Sam Houstons and the UTEPs and the Stephen F. Austin's and hung, you know, 59, 69, et cetera, on them to really build up, you know, incredible offensive looking numbers early in the year. What I noticed immediately when I looked at Texas Tech is, I mean, they were giving up, like you pointed out, they gave up 32.4 points per contest defensively in the first half of his seasons and 41.9 points per game afterward. And so, by the way, that just by definition means your offense isn't getting the same number of opportunities, which is one of the reasons your scoring might be down as well. But their offense has never slowed down or got figured out. Their defense is, I mean, they gave up 82 in a game to TCU and 70, you know, in 60s regularly in some of those Big 12 games. But I think the injuries are really a big part of the Arizona narrative for sure.
Yeah, and again, like, I don't want to rule anything out here. If you want to say Cliff has a smaller playbook than other teams, or maybe he's slow to react to other teams, or maybe he doesn't have the, you know, the plan Bs, the plan Cs other teams have, I'm willing to believe that's a possibility. But I just think this argument of, oh, you know, he gets figured out and it's too simple, that just is too simplistic of an argument for me. There's too many holes in that thing. I think, you know, the argument is more than just a table with his records and the points per game. That is just too simplistic of a way to analyze football. And I just don't think it does anyone any justice, including this year's Commanders.
No doubt. I mean, proving, you know, disproving a past narrative doesn't, you know, preclude you from, you know, saying that it might become a future narrative. But sure. In terms of what it was at Texas Tech in Arizona with him as a head coach, it wasn't exclusively an offense getting figured out issue. Far from it. So since I have you on, what have you seen? What are your thoughts on Washington going from what was an unstoppable offensive team to three losses in a row to Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and then Sunday to Dallas, and not being as unstoppable offensively?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of things, right? You know, you start with Jaden Daniels, and he's been a little less accurate, and he was so good at, you know, hitting those out routes, throwing against pressure. He felt like he had answers very quickly, and he just has missed some throws. I whether that's a rib injury or not, I certainly can't say. There were some throws in the game on Sunday where he had open receiver and just wasn't able to hook up. There were some drops, you know, when I went back and watched that were an issue, that I think they weren't dropping as many passes earlier in the year. The running game was better the first half of the year in terms of big plays. They've had, I think, one 20-plus yard run during this losing streak, and that was the Jaden Daniels scramble late in the game on Sunday during, I think, the touchdown drive before the crazy 81-yard play. But they haven't had any big runs in the running game, and that was really an explosive part of the offense, whether it was Nichols, whether it was Eckler, whether it was Brian Robinson, whether it was Daniels. They were hitting a lot of explosive runs earlier in the season. They're converting third downs less. They're down to about 34%, which I think is partly a product of being, you know, stuck in less favorable downs and distances on third down, and also you know, I think having a little more pass protection issues. I think teams have been a little better at attacking some of the weaknesses of the pass pro here for the Commanders. But the biggest thing to me is the schedule, right? I mean, this was a situation where first half of the year, they were not playing a lot of tough defenses. And I know the Cowboys, not a tough defense by the numbers. They did have Micah Parsons back, which is, I think, obviously helps that defense significantly versus what we saw from them earlier in the year. But, you know, playing the Steelers, playing the Eagles, those are the two of the five best defenses in football. And that, to me, is a very reasonable thing that would cause you to struggle. And I just think the other thing I would say, Kevin, to finish up this very rambly answer, is, you know, when we talked about this team entering the year, the expectations were so low because of what was around Jaden Daniels, right? I mean, this is not an imposing offensive line on paper. This is, outside of Terry McLaurin, not an impressive group of receivers on paper. And so I do think you have to set expectations appropriately. Like, this is, you know, this is not a situation where you have stars who are going to carry this team if Jaden Daniels is not playing out of his mind. And if Jaden Daniels is less than 100%, it's going to be tough to find the pieces, the people who can overcome that, because outside of Terry McLaurin, there's not those guys who are difference makers on paper.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is true. I think one of the things for me in the last few weeks, I've pointed out ad nauseum the fact that Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are really good, not to mention they played them in 4 days, you know. And Philly basically had a rest game against the Cowboys. Washington had gone to the limit against Pittsburgh. By the way, real quickly, I'm just curious. Where are you on Philly right now? Where are they among the NFL elites? Because it seems like their defense has put them, and Barkley has put them right there with Detroit and Kansas City and Buffalo.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think really scares me about the Eagles, is the defense is so much better. I mean, you look at the numbers. The offense is basically where it was a year ago. Saquon has made a big difference, but the passing game has been a little worse because of the injuries to A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith, and they've had some injuries on the offensive line as well. So the passing game has been more inconsistent. But the defense, I mean, it is way better than where it was a year ago. And obviously, that's what really hurt them during the second half of the year when they kept losing games. They couldn't cover anybody. Their pass rush shut down. Their coverage was a mess. I think adding those rookies, adding DeJean, adding Quinny Mitchell in the secondary, those guys have both been hits. And they've been, I think, the best defense in football since week five. So, you know, that is a very scary formula to me, is when you have that kind of running back, that kind of offensive line, and that kind of defense, you can win a lot of games deep into the season.
Do you like them as much as you like Detroit?
That's a tough question. I actually am a little skeptical of Detroit, even though they've been managing to pull it off. I just, you know, Kevin, I can't think of a team in the history of the National Football League who won a Super Bowl who had a less imposing pass rush on paper than these Detroit Lions. And I really feel bad they lost Aiden Hutchinson. They lost Marcus Davenport. They did get Za'Darius Smith, and that is a veteran who's going to help, but he's not the same guy he was 4 or 5 years ago. They've been covering. They've been blitzing a lot. They've been great in the secondary. They're winning with coverage now and winning with blitzes as opposed to winning with their pass rush. But it's just the old school part of me. Like, you know, you have to have that guy who can't be blocked. You have to have your Chris Jones, you know, deep into a playoff run. And I don't know if the Lions have that guy. So as good as the offense is, I'm a little scared that they're going to run into a team that's going to be able to throw on them or run on them because they don't have that guy who's going to be a disruptor up front.
That seems like a Barnwell column to come because we think about the quarterback. We think about, you know, stopping the run, running the football as, you know, pretty much givens, or it's got to be 2/3 of that to win a Super Bowl. I think about the Colts. We were talking about Peyton Manning earlier because I kind of comped Peyton Manning's first 7-8 years to Lamar Jackson's, not stylistically, yep, but in the way we thought about those, yep, quarterbacks in the moment, mm-hmm, like really great, yep, but, you know, they can't do it in the, yep, postseason. And until Lamar clears that hurdle, we'll probably think that way. But I was thinking about, mm-hmm, their Super Bowl team. They weren't a great defensive team, but I think they got Mathis back late before that Super Bowl run, and they had a pass rush in the postseason. So where does pass rush rank in terms of – it sounds like you have a gut feel that it's important and you're not going to win one without a pass rush.
I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. And there are teams who have done it in bulk, right? I mean, the Buccaneers, when they beat the Chiefs that year, it was not like, you know, Shaq Barrett's a really good player, Vita Vega's a really good player. It's not like they had, you know, an all-pro pass rusher, but they had 5 or 6 guys who were really good, who had been productive as pros. The Lions don't really have that. And I just, you know, there might be a team I'm not thinking of. I don't want to rule it out. And they're so good everywhere else that maybe they're the exception and they can pull it off. But, I mean, it is just a really hard thing to do historically. You know, think about the Chiefs last year, how many times they were in key situations in the postseason and they got bailed out because Chris Jones made a play. Ran down Josh Allen.
Was Fletcher Cox that for Philadelphia's year? I'm trying to think of like when the Eagles with Nick Foles won it, yeah, did they have a dominant pass rusher, or we just throw Fletcher Cox and how great he was into that?
That's a good point. I would say Fletcher Cox is probably the closest thing, and the Lions don't have a Fletcher Cox caliber player to me, but they were a very deep pass rush, certainly. They had Brandon Graham, who's been really good for a long time, although sadly it's now half of the year. They had Chris Long, who had been really productive for the Rams. They were a team where, okay, you don't have that one guy, but you can roll 6, 7, 8 guys. And, oh, by the way, Kevin, I'll play on that game. Tom Brady threw for 500 yards, and they lost. So,
true.
You know, if you can win a game where, you know, the guy on the other side of the field throws for 500, the Lions can beat the Chiefs where Mahomes throws for 505 yards, hey, you know, I will tip my cap and say I was wrong. But it is really tough to pull off. So,
Von Miller twice for two different teams, if you just go back in recent years. You know, Seattle obviously had a dominant pass rush. New England, whether it was one great one, they schemed it up better than anybody else.
Yeah, right. You know, but I'll tell you what, though. I've been waiting for weeks to say, okay, you know, the Lions lost to me, the guy who was the defensive player of the year before he got hurt, Aiden Hutchinson. You know, okay, well, we were going to see the effect of that in the weeks to come. They haven't felt it yet. They have been really good. Aaron Glenn's done a great job of creating pressure with blitzes. Their secondary has been really good. They're getting with, you know, they're playing with, I think, the highest blitz rate in football. So they're finding ways. So I don't want to rule it out, but that is just my one concern about the Lions, that to me, pretty much every other big contender around the NFL has a guy who can get you a pressure in a key situation.
Yeah, they are down the list right now in sacks. That's for sure. They've got 25 total on the season. That looks to be about 25th, 24th in the NFL. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And yet they don't, every time they play, it just seems like they're not going to lose.
Right.
But we'll see. Who do you like in the AFC?
Oh, gosh. So here's the thing, Kevin. And I'm going to sound like I'm bragging, and I want you to give me a second to prove that I'm not bragging.
I'll give you more than a second.
I said the Chiefs are going to win 16 games this year before the season. And they might do that, and I still might be wrong, because the team I expected to see before the year is right. not the Chiefs we have seen actually play out this year. They have not been good deep passing. Obviously, the injuries to Rice and Brown hurt. I was expecting them to be better with the football, protect the football, and have a better turnover rate. They have not done that. Mahomes has been very sloppy with the football. But they're the Chiefs. They pull it out, right? I mean, every game it feels like they make, you know, Bryce Young look like he's going to beat them, and then they pull out something in the last second. Mahomes is a 33-yard scramble instead of a field goal. This is a weaker Chiefs team to me than last year by a comfortable margin. They were much better on defense than they were a year ago. They miss Isaiah Pacheco. I think getting him back is going to help. And maybe getting DJ Humphries, the left tackle they signed, is going to upgrade what's really been the weakest spot on their roster, with Lonnie Morris and Kingsley Suamataya struggling at left tackle. But, I mean, I have to stick with them just because I picked them before the year. I picked them to win the Super Bowl each of the last 5 years. I've been right the last 2 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're not – even though I was very high on them before the year, even though they are 10-1, they're not living up to my expectations. So I feel like it's really up in the air at this point. I'm just sticking with the Chiefs because they were my pick before the season.
All right, last one. Does Barkley have a legitimate case to be the MVP?
Ooh, it's tough. And I don't want to nitpick, right? He's been so good at his best. And to me, I had him behind Derrick Henry until last week. Now he's ahead of Derrick Henry for me. And the only issue is we have seen him struggle in moments that have cost the Eagles even victories. Remember week two? Third and two or third and three against the Falcons. He drops that pass that would have given them a first down or a touchdown to win the game. Falcons come back after the field goal. They win the game. Would have been over. Jaguars game, he fumbles untouched. The Jaguars score a touchdown. Later in that game, he slides down early on a play that would have trying to kill clock, and then they have the punt. Jaguars get the ball with a chance back to win the game. Against the Browns, or first half of that game, he comes up short on second and one, gives up a sack in pass protection on third and one, and then the Browns walk a field goal returner for a touchdown. That becomes a closer game than it should have been. It's not fair, because you can make those cases maybe for quarterbacks who have made mistakes, and it's not really, you know, if with Lamar taking a step backwards the past couple of weeks, well, he was really good last night. You know, I feel like Barkley has drawn more of the attention, and this is really the year of the sort of resurgent running back, so I could see it going to him. I could see it going to Henry. I think he has a case. If he gets over 2,000 yards, he's on pace for about 2,150 right now with the 17th game.
If he breaks Eric Dickerson's record, I was thinking about this because I asked my last guest this. If he breaks Eric Dickerson's record, he's the MVP.
Has to be. And it should be. And no, there would be... I would have no issue at all with that being the case, even though he has a great offensive line, even though, obviously, he's had a few hiccups here and there. He has been so dominant. He's so good at taking advantage of your mistakes. In that Rams game, they had two plays where they did not fit the run well, and there was a gap. And for, you know, a lesser running back, for, you know, a Miles Sanders, who's a good player when he was healthy, but who's not Saquon Barkley, okay, you get 10 yards, you get 15 yards, you get 20 yards. When you give Saquon Barkley a crease, it's over. It is absolutely over. You are not catching him in the open field. You're not catching him one-on-one. That guy who's your last line of protection, that guy is not tackling Saquon Barkley. And so, to me, I feel like if he gets even close to Dickerson, if he gets over 2K, to me, I think he should be the favorite to win MVP.
You're the best. Thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it. Hope you're well. Happy Thanksgiving.
Kevin, love talking ball anytime.
Bill Barnwell, everybody, at Bill Barnwell on X. And good stuff on the Kingsbury stuff. He went deep and did the homework on what happened in those seasons at Texas Tech and at Arizona. Doesn't mean that maybe starting now, Kingsbury's offenses are going to fall apart in the second half of the season, and it's going to be because of the offense rather than other factors, injuries, comparing it to, you know, easier schedules earlier in the season, you know, having a terrible defense, which, by the way, after Sunday, still not bought into the defense. I'm going to get to that next hour. But we'll do some Denton news next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. All right, Denton, what do you got?
All right, let's start in college basketball. How about that? College basketball in November does exist.
Well, it's Maui, man. It's Thanksgiving week is football and, you know, used to be college hoops. I mean, I'm into it. But you got to talk about the Memphis UConn game and Danny Hurley losing his mind.
I mean, Danny Hurley losing his absolute mind. It was a tie game. UConn's ranked number two in the country right now. It was 92-92 in overtime with 40 seconds left. And Danny Hurley is just berating the official. The holdback coach, assistant coach, is trying to do his best. He cannot. He is just giving it to the refs. He gets a technical. It causes UConn to ultimately end up losing the game. It's their first loss of the year. And then he got to a press conference and didn't take accountability whatsoever for yelling at the ref, blaming them instead for their, quote, bleepy calls that he said. He just went nuts.
So this game, I was not watching it, but I had friends, Steve Sands and Tim Murray, and I are on this group text where it's usually, you know, gambling talk, but the two of them were just, you got to turn this thing on. It's great. And I couldn't. And then when I did turn it on, it was in the final few seconds of overtime. So I missed all of this stuff, but I went back and watched it. First of all, it's 92-92 in overtime in the Maui Invitational quarterfinals. All right, UConn, number two in the country, two-time defending national champion. They haven't lost in their last 17 games going back to last year. I think everybody's now familiar with UConn has become a dominant program again. And Danny Hurley, let me just say, is a great coach. A great coach. He's also got a screw loose, and that's been the case for many, many years. But, you know, personally, if he's my coach, that screw can loosen up to the point where you completely lose it a few times a year. I'm fine with that. The call that he complained about was an over-the-back call at 92-92 with 40 seconds left in overtime on a missed shot and an attempted offensive rebound. It's not a bad call. I mean, the guy did climb his back a little bit. Now, he picked it cleanly. I think anybody that knows anything about basketball, it's like, if you go over a guy's back, and even if you get the ball because you're taller and longer and you don't make contact, if you have to reach over that guy's head to get the ball, 8, 9 times out of 10, that's getting called. All right, it just is. Guy boxed out well. Hurley later said it was a lazy box out. And he lost it, completely lost it. And he gets teed up. So not only is the guy going to the line to shoot two free throws off the over-the-back call, but you got two technical free throws on top of that. Memphis hit all of them. They took a four-point lead. And bottom line is they did have a shot at a three at the end, at a three at the end to win it down two after they intentionally missed a free throw. But they lost the game to Memphis. Memphis, by the way, was not a ranked team under Penny Hardaway, but they were 4-0 or 5-0, something like that, going into the game. And then he completely lost it in the press conference and called out the refs, said that they should be embarrassed with the call, should be embarrassed with hitting with a tech. He went after him pretty hard. I do think sometimes referees need to consider the moment. This is apparently one of the highest level games that you'll see in November. It was a great basketball game. It's in overtime. You got a hot-headed coach. You know that. He didn't come out onto the floor. He was still walking up the sideline. And like you said, the assistant was holding him back. I think you probably let that one go no matter. I don't know what he was saying.
I don't know. I don't know what he was saying to him.
Well, it's the moment, right? Because you know if you hit him with a tech, it may be the game decider right there, which it was. It basically decided the game. He lost it after the game. When the buzzer went off, I was watching it at that point. But did go back to congratulate Penny Hardaway on a hard-fought win. But, man, Hurley is something else, man. He is a show. Like, not only is the team great and has been great and exceptionally well-coached and has been, but his antics and his temper and his loss of poise on the sideline, you know, it's not Bobby Knight-esque necessarily. Knight had, all due respect to Danny Hurley, who is, you know, I'm not saying that he's not as bright as Knight. Knight had a sense of humor that went through, that went with his complete inability to control his temper. And by the way, you know, a bully in many ways. Hurley doesn't, I don't think, have that. I don't think he's got that sense of humor to go with it. But it is a show when you watch UConn. Anyway, so they're done in Maui, although they will play other games, because when you travel all the way to Maui, there's a loser's bracket as well. I don't know who's in that tournament, to be honest with you. Is Carolina in that tournament? I think they are.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm not paying attention to basketball right now.
Yeah, because I was flipping around last night, and it looked like they were playing in that gym as well, and they were playing Dayton. To be honest with you, I don't know if they won or lost their game. Anyway, what do you got next?
All right, how about some more college talk? UNC is planning on relieving Mack Brown of his duties after the NC State game this weekend, so he more likely than not will not coach in the bowl game for the UNC Tar Heels football program. And they're going to be entering a coaching search. He's a legend. He won a national championship with Texas.
So he is going to coach the season finale against NC State?
That is currently the plan. We'll see if that changes.
Good for him.
But it's funny because like a week ago, he said that he plans on being back next year.
Okay.
And then they said, well, no.
Yeah, they tell me, correct me if I'm wrong, I think with Sam Howell, or was it the year, was it Drake May? One of those 2 years, they had a really good year, but their defense was horrific.
That was a Sam Howell year.
It was the Sam Howell year?
It was one of them, yeah.
Yeah. And then last year was Drake May, right? And they weren't that great, correct?
Correct. I mean, they have not had a good defense in years.
What's his overall record at Carolina? His overall record at Carolina the first go-round, they were a major factor multiple times in the ACC, had really good teams. And then obviously he goes to Texas. He wins a national championship. They had an opportunity in the game that Colt McCoy got hurt in to win another one. Am I forgetting? Was it just two national championship games, the win over USC and then the loss to Oklahoma?
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, multiple Rose Bowl appearances, multiple New Year's Six games. So in the Cotton Bowl a bunch, in the Rose Bowl a bunch, in the Fiesta Bowl, the BCS National Championship. Yeah.
He's been a hell of a coach.
Yeah, I mean, he got to an Orange Bowl with UNC in 2020.
Yeah, but they didn't win. I'm trying to think. Did they get to an ACC championship game and get blown out by Clemson?
I'll have to check on that, because that 2020 was a weird year. The most wins he had at UNC was 9 in 2022. He had 8 in 2021.
So the 2022 is the Sam Howell year? No.
No, 2022 was the first Drake May year. The 2020 season was the Sam Howell year.
So if 2022 was the year that I think they made it to an ACC championship game with Drake May. Maybe they didn't.
They made it. I think that they made it to one. It looks like that they won. They beat Miami.
Oh, they beat Miami.
Yeah, that was in 2020. That was the Sam Howell year. That's why they got to the Orange Bowl, because they won the ACC.
Sorry. Whatever. The Carolina teams this go around for Mack Brown were marked by terrible defense. Great offense, terrible defense. How old's Mack Brown?
He's old.
75?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely up there in age. He is.
Yeah. Had a hell of a career. Look, I mean, when the first go-round with Carolina before he got the Texas job, the Heels were, you know, during the 90s, you know, 80s, I think he was there for the late 80s into the 90s. They had some really, really good football teams. And, you know, Florida State was obviously the king of the league. I mean, they were more so, much more so than Clemson during his first go-round. But they had really, really good football teams. Just thinking about some of the players on those teams, like Ekuban, and they had good. They were much better defensively. The guy that played for the Cowboys, defensive lineman, forgetting. Anyway, hell of a coach. That'll be it for him, right?
More, I mean, yeah, I can't imagine. You're 73 years old. I don't know why you'd still want to be coaching in today's day and age, where you got to do so much. Like, go rest. You've won
Carolina
national
is one of those places. If they get the right guy, they can certainly. Yes, it's a basketball first school, like, you know, many in the ACC have been over the years, or at least the old ACC. But they care deeply about football as well. It's a beautiful school. Keenan Stadium is a first-rate facility. Looks beautiful in the fall. Been to games there before. You can win big at Carolina. You know, in this day and age with a 12-team playoff, you can definitely be a team in the ACC that threatens the playoff once every 4 or 5 years. And Mack Brown wasn't doing that. So I understand why they're looking for something better. But like with all of these basketball first schools, said this for years, be careful what you wish for. When you have a good football coach, you know, and you're winning more games than you're losing consistently, that's why I hated the Friedgen firing at Maryland during the 2000s. Just stupid. The guy had gone to 7 bowl games in 10 seasons. Maryland was actually a factor in the ACC. He was a hell of a coach. Hell of a coach, Ralph was. And, you know, after he was named the ACC Coach of the Year, they moved on from him. That was so dumb. And they didn't get back to any semblance of even winning seasons until Locks. And the last 3 years before this season, of course. I mean, be careful what you wish for at these basketball first schools. If you've got somebody that's good enough and you're winning more than you're losing, sometimes it can go the complete opposite direction. You know, because Mack Brown's a good coach, but maybe he was ready to hang it up too. All right, what else?
All right, this sent me over the edge yesterday. The jokes on Twitter were flying. Drake is suing Universal Music Group and Spotify over Kendrick Lamar's song "Not Like Us."
And why is he suing them?
Well, so "Not Like Us." Have you heard the song "Not Like Us"?
This is the one. Is this the one where he's ripping Drake again?
It is, where he calls him a pedophile.
Right.
But he is suing not for defamation. He is suing because he feels like UMG and Spotify, which, by the way, he is signed to UMG, a $400 million deal. He is suing them because he feels like they boosted the numbers on the first day that Not Like Us was released.
Boosted the numbers. That's, by the way, that's a big topic in, you know, the Spotify, Apple world.
It is.
In terms of, you know, how those numbers are accounted for. There's been so many different iterations of measurement techniques and what's acceptable, I don't know anything about this. I mean, they hate each other's guts, clearly.
Clearly.
It's kind of too bad, but I don't know anything about, like, are they inflating the numbers? And why would they inflate the numbers when he is a UMG, you know, client?
Well, so that is a massive question. But the humor in this is that the guy that has been accused multiple times of inflating his own numbers is Drake.
Right.
It has been happening literally every time he drops an album because his last couple albums have been awful.
Mm-hmm.
I just think, it's, like, okay, if you're going to sue, first of all, suing at the end of a rap battle.
How bad is Not Like Us? Because, I remember
it's
reading
phenomenal.
About it. It just came out recently, right?
It came out in May. It's phenomenal. It's one of my favorite songs of the year.
Okay. And it's just, it attacks him and calls and refers to Drake as a pedophile.
It does. Oh, it was so good. It was so great.
What a world. All right, what else?
Juan Soto got 5 teams in the mix for him. He's had official offers from 5 teams. Our final story here. Red Sox, Yankees, Dodgers, Mets, and Blue Jays. You will notice no Phillies, no Nationals in that.
Yeah, I mean, the Nats just, you know, they're not going to spend that kind of money for Juan Soto. It's small town. Feel badly sometimes for one of the better GMs in the game, Mike Rizzo, for sure. But it's really a small, even though the market's a big market, you know, from every standpoint, from a size, from a demographic standpoint, et cetera, they just think smaller than other clubs. We got other things to get to. By the way, Steve Buckhantz is going to jump on with us at 12:35. He and Phil are doing the alt cast of the Wizards game, I guess, tonight on the Monumental Sports Group station. And so we'll talk to him about that. But Buck also texted me during the game Sunday about Austin Seibert. Buck knows a lot about kickers. He was one. So Buck will join us at 12:35. Up next, we'll go around the NFL. Didn't have a chance to do that. We'll go back and look at Sunday's other games, which there were some crazy ones. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. Before we go around the NFL, which we'll do in about 5 minutes, I wanted to just emphasize this. Right now, Saquon Barkley's on pace to finish with 2,151 yards in the season. Now, it's 17 games versus Eric Dickerson's 16 in 1984, but that would eclipse Eric Dickerson by 46 yards. He rushed for 2,105 yards in a season, and it's still held all of these years. I mean, we're at 40 years of that record being a record for single-season rushing, and it still holds. If Saquon Barkley breaks Eric Dickerson's record, he's the MVP. Like, there won't be a debate. I don't care what Josh Allen does or Lamar Jackson does. A 40-year record falling in that category, the most rushing yards in an NFL season, especially on a team, you know, let's also say that if he ends up breaking the record, Philly continued to play well, won the division more likely than not, and maybe even, you know, fought it out for a one seed, maybe past Detroit, who knows, to be the one seed. But I'm telling you, the running back, you know, hasn't happened since Adrian Peterson. It's become a quarterback award. That's out the window if he breaks Eric Dickerson's record. He's going to win the MVP. And I think the interesting part of Philadelphia's team, we've talked about this, is that if you go back to the Rams teams of John Robinson, who just passed away recently, Eric Dickerson, those teams, Eric Dickerson and their running attack was the team. Like, that was what they had. They didn't have a quarterback. Their defenses were pretty good, though. They were. If Philly wins a lot of games and Saquon Barkley breaks that record, you could still make the case that Philly won 14 games or 15 games or whatever it ends up being because of their defense as much as it would be Barkley. Dickerson was the guy on those Rams teams. But if he breaks the record, if he's the all-time leading rusher, I don't see any way in hell he's not the MVP. That's a long-standing record. I mean, that it's not that it was a record that nobody thought would ever be broken, but, you know, as we became a more pass-heavy, you know, sport, as the NFL became that, it became less likely. You know, the last time anybody rushed for, well, Derrick Henry did in 2020 during the COVID season. He rushed for more than 2,000 yards. But the last time it happened was the last time an NFL running back won the MVP, and that was Adrian Peterson in 2012, and he rushed for 2,097 yards and came, you know, 108 away from Dickerson's record. Still, you know, a ways away from the record. I guess you could look at it and say if Barkley does it in 17 games, but Dickerson broke O.J. Simpson's record, which was done in 14 games, and it was still a big deal. Like, do you agree with me on that, Denton? If he sets the record for rushing yards in a season?
First of all, as a running back to win an MVP, you have to. You have to do something that is historic or something iconic. You can't just have a great season. It has to be some sort of record-breaking deal, and if that ends up being the case, then yes, there's nothing that Lamar or Josh Allen, with respect to both of those guys, there's nothing that they're doing that is so historic that it would overcome a running back breaking a record that stood as long as Dickerson's has.
You know, the other non-quarterback to win the MVP, other than Adrian Peterson 2012 in this century, actually the other two, were LT, Sean Alexander, well, actually Marshall Faulk did as well. And none of those guys rushed for more than 2,000 yards in a season.
But they broke touchdown records.
Oh, right.
That's what I'm saying. You have to do something historic. Sean Alexander broke that touchdown record that I believe was set by Marshall Faulk, who broke the touchdown record when he won, and then LaDainian Tomlinson did it as well.
Yeah. I find personally the overall yards record to be more significant than the touchdown record. But if Saquon Barkley does it, he's a lock to win the MVP, in my opinion. Something Jerry Jones said this morning on his radio show down in Dallas, we'll get to next, along with the rest of the NFL games from Sunday, which we did not have a chance to talk about on yesterday's show. Kevin Sheehan Show, The Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.